This is the Morrow Midday Show.
But wait, there's more.
On ESPN Radio.
Yes, back again. Shady's back. Tell a friend. Guess who's back?
Final hour of the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. Coming up, we'll get to our Tuesday Top 10, the greatest upsets in sports history. Now that I think we can add another one to the list from Saturday's Kentucky Derby. Get to that coming up. Plus, the biggest takeaways or stories right now in the NBA as we move along in the final four series, or at least down to four series in the NBA playoffs. If you ever miss anything from the show, you can always catch it on demand. Just search ESPN Radio Charleston, however you listen to your podcasts. Podcasts are also available online at charlestonsportsradio.com. Just click on our show page, find the show on demand there. There have been some issues with those podcasts, but hopefully we'll be back up and running soon. And you can always get in touch with the show. Reach out online at charlestonsportsradio.com by, again, clicking on our show page. You can always text the show, 843-608-1734. You can always join the conversation on the phones, 843-721-9500. Or you can always get to us on Twitter as well, at Morrow Middays. Hey, it's that time of year again. We're getting ready for the 2022 Summer Golf Tour. Looks like it begins next week. The links at Stono Ferry. So stay tuned for that. I'll have to check to see if it's up and running on the website already. But our annual, you know it by now, the Summer Golf Tour, we're at a different golf course every week for 10 weeks with great prices, $98.90 for a foursome at great courses starting next week. The links at Stono Ferry. Usually the foursomes go on sale at the very beginning of the week, and they go fast. So stay tuned for that. Looks like it starts next week. I just read what is handed to me. And it looks like the first week is next week. So stay tuned for that. That's when you know you're reaching the summer, when the Summer Golf Tour comes around here at ESPN Radio Charleston. Go out and golf every week for the next couple of weeks. Now officially it becomes summer. It was nice to return back to the Lowcountry. A little windy today, right? But some nice weather. Not too hot. I went out of town this past weekend. It got over 100 degrees in the feel-like temperature this weekend. It was hot. So it was a welcomed return back to the Lowcountry. We'll get into all the NBA playoffs and such from the last couple of days. I was still able to pay attention while I was out of town. Now, I have a group of buddies that I grew up with where there's about 10 of us. And so we all got together this past weekend, not knowing at the time that it was Mother's Day weekend, which made it tough on some of the guys. Married men now, fathers. But nonetheless, Mother's Day, that's okay. Let's all get together. Only one person really couldn't make the trip. So the rest of us got together. We got an Airbnb in a place. We went hung out for a weekend. One of my buddies was going to get the groceries delivered for when we arrived.
Okay.
As he's doing it online, days in advance, he's going to get some bananas. He figures it's by the number of bananas. So he puts in 18. Let me get 18 bananas. It was not by the single banana. It was by, like, the bundle, the bunches. So we wound up with, like, 100 bananas in the house for nine of us.
Your
for
potassium
five
levels
days.
Must have been through the roof.
Oh, fantastic. We were nailing it. So we show up, and the groceries get delivered, and I was sitting in the kitchen, and some of my other buddies were bringing it in, and they just kept coming in with the bananas. And we're thinking, what's going on? What's with all the bananas? The guy that ordered the groceries showed up later on. He was shocked. We didn't say anything. He walked in, and on the counter of the kitchen, the counter was just covered in bananas, and he got a real kick out of it. And it was a funny thing. And so for the buddy that was not there, that couldn't come on the trip, we had the idea we're going to order 100 bananas to his house.
Oh, nice.
And that's what we did. So we did it on Friday, and they delivered 100 bananas to his front door and left them there. Right? And then we did it again Saturday. We didn't hear anything on Friday. So we did it again Saturday. He sent another 100 bananas to him at his doorstep. Didn't hear anything Saturday. Did it again. Sent another 100 bananas. And finally, We didn't hear anything from him. So we thought, this is odd. So in the group text, we used the term banana just in passing. Something along the lines of like, man, this trip has been bananas.
Right, right.
To try to, you know, help him connect the dots. He did not understand. And we always pull pranks on one another. So he should have known when everybody else is together and I'm not there and I'm getting bananas randomly sent to my house, he should have assumed it was because all of us were together pulling a quote-unquote prank on him. Never put two and two together. Then he gets in our group text the word banana. That should be the red flag. Here you go. Now you know, oh, it was them sending me the bananas.
Right.
Still hasn't registered. to this moment, he still doesn't know it was us. He responded in that text, I'll tell you what's bananas, is what he says. They've been delivering bananas to my house 3 days in a row. I don't know who's doing it. Still doesn't know. And so now in our conversation sense, we keep using the word bananas, kind of pigeonholing it in. You know, like I said yesterday, I sent a text, said, hey, let me know who I owe for some things, for the groceries, for the rental cars, whatever. Some of you guys, you were going bananas with the spending this weekend. Let me know who I owe money to. Same idea, right? He hasn't picked up on it. So we're going to keep doing it.
I was going to say, drag it out
until
as long
he finally
as
picks
possible.
Up on it.
Yeah. Maybe keep sending bananas. Maybe yeah. Every weekend just send over, you know, but it's going to get pricey, as you were saying. Like, you're sending 100 bananas a day plus delivery fee, yeah. Luke. I mean, add taxes in there, inflation. What are we doing?
We have a wedding coming up this summer at his hotel room. We're going to have bananas brought
Ooh,
up to the hotel
yeah.
room.
Oh, yeah. Every night.
He has no idea. So he responded in the text. He said, I got 200 bananas now on my doorstep, whatever. He said, we're going to freeze some. We're going to use some to make banana bread. We're probably going to hand some out. He has no idea how these bananas wound up. And he's, you know what? To his credit, he's going to try to make the most out of them. I tell you what, though. If I walked out my front door and there's bananas sitting there, first day, like, okay, that's kind of strange. Happens again. Happens a third time. You know something's up. But I'm not trusting these bananas. I'm not putting them in the freezer to have later. I'm wondering, what are these bananas doing here? What is someone trying to do to me? I'm not even bringing those bananas in the house. I'm putting them right in the garbage.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I didn't order the bananas. I don't care for your bananas. Whoever's dropping them at my doorstep, I don't want them. I can't trust those bananas.
Some poisonous bananas.
Yeah,
you know, somebody's trying to get you. You know, they're thinking, all right, I'm going to send him a bunch, and there's going to be one in there, one bad apple. He's going to look at it, looks good, and then boom.
Could be, for all you know.
You're done.
So one of my buddies couldn't come on the trip. He's now got a freezer full of bananas. Like the Bluth family. He's waiting to use all these bananas.
Should have came on the trip, pal.
That's right. Should have
came on the trip.
Although, I don't know. If you're a big banana guy, maybe this is, you know, you're feeling good. Like, man, I'm not going on the next trip so they can send me more bananas. So we're going to keep sending bananas to him until he finally picks up on it. Don't worry, though. While I was gone, I was able to keep up with all the action. You know, you usually, I imagine, probably pick friends that have similar interests. So when we all get together, we're just watching the games anyways through various activities. So we were watching all the games over the weekend. My main takeaways from the NBA playoffs, as we're down to the final four rounds here, final four matchups here, and they're all pretty good. Three of the four series are tied at two. Then you have Golden State that really put a dagger into Memphis last night to go up 3-1. The main takeaway from the four. First, let me give you my main takeaway from last night, that when you have an opportunity to put a team away, you have to do it. And in both cases last night, Memphis let Golden State hang around. The Bucks let the Celtics hang around. And for Memphis, it really cost them their season. Golden State found the way to win at home, veteran team. You knew it was going to happen. They were going to heat up eventually. They played better in the fourth quarter. Steph Curry got going. They missed their first 15 threes last night. For the Golden State Warriors, you knew eventually they're going to start making their shots. And even if you don't have Ja Morant on your side, if you're Memphis, you have to find a way to turn that into a win. Put your foot down on the gas. Pull away from them. Right? Don't look back. Don't look in the rearview mirror. Get away from them as quickly as you can. Build that lead. Hold on to that double-digit lead. They could not. Now they're down 3-1. They're done. You're not going to win the next three against Golden State, especially if Ja Morant can't return for Game 5. For Milwaukee, same idea. You could have put the series almost out of hand last night with a victory to go up 3-1. Now, to the Bucks' credit, the Celtics kind of blew Game 3. So the Bucks responded. You know, they won Game 3. They coughed up Game 4. You could say it's a wash. But last night we had two situations where two teams couldn't put away their opponent, couldn't go for the jugular, let them hang around. It's the oldest cliche in sports. You hear it all the time. Don't let them hang around. Right? It usually catches up to you. You failed to put a team away early, they'll catch up and most likely win the game, especially in basketball. And then the other two series, what's interesting for Phoenix against Dallas and Miami against Philadelphia, we've been talking about it throughout the afternoon. But the connecting factor between those two series is that you're waiting to see what the star does next. Chris Paul for Phoenix, and in this case, James Harden for Philadelphia. Harden had the best game he's had in a long time the other night, helping the Sixers tie up the series with Miami. What can he do tonight as an encore? I've already gone on record this afternoon. I don't expect the same type of output. In fact, I would expect, compared to Game 4, a disappointing Game 5 for Harden, because I don't think he has that left in him to be able to do from game to game. But what's so vexing about the whole situation is that when you can see him do it in Game 4, you know that it's still in there, that he's still capable of putting together a performance like that. And even if it's not every night, even if he's not leading the league in scoring like a couple years ago, still, you'd like to see that performance more often than we have gotten. Because really, until last night, we have not seen a game like that from James Harden since arriving in Philadelphia, at least not since the first 2 weeks he was there. The big question now is the encore. What can he do to follow it up tonight? I don't think he'll play as well. On the flip side, for Phoenix and Dallas, Chris Paul was really bad in Game 4, and it allowed Dallas to tie the series. And now you're sweating it out a little bit more if you're Phoenix. Granted, you get to go home, and you're home two of the next three in what becomes a three-game series. You have home court advantage in that mini three-game series now. But Chris Paul just played a really poor game, allowed Dallas to tie up the series. And if Paul, say, struggles again in Game 5, or if the Suns fall behind in Game 5, or if they just lose this series, it'll just be another thing to add to the resume of Chris Paul and his shortcomings in the playoffs. But it's not just that he may lose series. It's also how they lose series. I mean, last year, they blew their series with Milwaukee. So often, you go back and you look, Chris Paul blows series leads. He is the Doc Rivers of players. And they were up 2-0. Now the series is tied. Chris Paul played terribly in Game 4, fouled out, had the issue with the Mavericks fans. Who knows what truly happened, what was going on. But it's all part of it. Now the pressure certainly is on Phoenix. You're feeling good up 2-0. They're kind of mocking Luka Doncic in their press conferences, which seems silly because Luka was killing them. But they were going at him when they had the basketball. They were attacking Luka when he was on defense, and he couldn't stop them, and they were having a good time and joking around. You go to Dallas, things change when you go on the road. We've seen these series switch, right, when it changes location. Philadelphia, down 2-0 without Embiid in Miami, didn't look very good. Looked like it was going to be an early exit. People were talking about Doc Rivers is going to be fired. Now suddenly they win the last two. If they win tonight, they take a series lead. The pressure becomes, you know, it all falls on Miami. It all falls on Phoenix. Dallas is playing with house money. Philadelphia is playing with house money. And so for the Suns, it's a big game tonight. Those are the two series going on tonight. And the 2-1 seeds better find a way to win. You're at home. You let your 2-0 lead slip away. And in the case of Phoenix especially, Chris Paul, right, you were lousy last game. How do you respond? Usually great players aren't bad for an extended period of time. We'll see in regards to Chris Paul. I also think for the Boston series along those lines, that was my concern with Jason Tatum. He's kind of disappeared these last two games. Al Horford was the big star yesterday. But in the defense of Tatum or maybe the Celtics, sometimes that's what it takes to be a championship team. You need your role players to step up every once in a while, have a big-time game. We'll see what happens tonight with those two series in terms of Phoenix, Dallas, Miami, Philadelphia. Big game fives. And when you look at these four series, Golden State has it wrapped up with Memphis. It's too bad Ja couldn't play last night. Memphis probably feels like they would have won if Ja Morant was available, and that would also be a 2-2 series. But otherwise, these other three series all tied at two. Game fives the next 36 hours are going to be wild. In Boston, in Miami, at Phoenix. Should be some fun game fives over the next 2 days that will really help decide these series. And the big story, of course, out of the NBA is the MVP award. And I believe that they got it right by giving it to Jokic for the second straight year. He would have been my MVP. But at the same time, I think the league does a disservice to the award winners by announcing it when they do. And this has only come out because it was like, theoretically, it was leaked. They're not officially announcing it till next week. But this year, the NBA is allowing their awards to be revealed before they actually do it. You know, it wasn't that long ago that they had, like, an award show. I don't think they do that anymore. They used to have an award show at the end of the year, like, the very end, and they give out all their awards, and, you know, it seemed like a nice night. But then you had a coach get the Coach of the Year award while he was already fired. The NBA does not do themselves any favor. The postseason is so long that it's like a whole other season. So when you want to give out the awards after the postseason, our perception has already – it's recency bias. We've already changed how we look at these guys, these players, these awards. Right now, you're watching Embiid and Giannis play, you're not watching Jokic. So it's that recency bias that you're thinking, wow, Jokic is the MVP. He's sitting at home. It doesn't look great. By the NBA could really help out their league, their players, their award winners by giving these awards right at the end of the regular season. And if you gave Jokic the MVP award at the very end of the regular season, it doesn't feel as bad as it may seem today. Because while Jokic is at home, Joel Embiid just showed his impact by coming back to even up that series with the number one seed. Giannis has showed his impact by playing really well this series without Chris Middleton, and right now in a 2-2 battle with the Celtics, who are a higher seed. And Jokic, like I said, is at home having won one playoff game. I think the NBA got it right, or at least the voters got it right in choosing Jokic, but the league doesn't get it right by choosing when to give out the award. Do it at the end of the regular season. It's a regular season award. There's no reason to wait. But by waiting, it just makes things look worse. Jokic is at home, and the two guys he beat out are playing big roles in big games. And that leads to a lot of people, especially NBA fans, but I've also seen media members, right, talking about it. Not a good look, but it has no impact on the award itself. Don't be swayed by what you're seeing in the postseason. I think Jokic is deserving of winning the MVP, and he's now won it back-to-back years, which is quite the accomplishment, especially for somebody who, as I said earlier, when he was drafted, they were in a commercial break. They didn't care. They were telling you about the latest chalupa while Jokic was coming into the NBA. And now he's a two-time MVP winner. Coming up, speaking of draft picks, you know, it's interesting. The number one pick typically does not work out, especially in the NBA. You would think it would be the opposite. Plus, we'll get to our top 10 list of the 10 biggest upsets in sports after what we saw in the Kentucky Derby this weekend. And we'll do that coming up as well. It's the More Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Attention campers, lunch has been canceled today due to lack of hustle. Deal with it.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
It's the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. And I was thinking about this. Around the NFL draft within the last couple of weeks, I was talking about the number one picks. If you go back and you look, and we ran through the list in the show, over the past decade, you look at the NFL draft, the number one pick really hasn't been the best player from the draft. Very rare. Joe Burrow may be the lone exception. We'll see as their careers play out, right? Because you still have to deal with somebody like Justin Herbert in that same draft class. So we'll see how things play out there. But typically when you go back and look at the NFL draft, the number one player is not the best player from their draft class. And the NBA is pretty similar as we try to compare Zion to Ja Morant. Right, and we give Zion a hard time. And it doesn't look great when he's on the sidelines and Ja Morant is playing well in the postseason. We saw how big of a loss Ja could have been to the Grizzlies last night. But I was just thinking about it. From the NFL draft to now this postseason, looking at the NBA, just this idea that maybe you don't want the number one pick, right? You have a better chance of selecting the better player actually later on in the draft. We all believe you want that number one pick and have the opportunity to choose whoever you want, but the best players from these drafts in the NFL, in the NBA, I'm sure Major League Baseball, if I went back and crunched the numbers there, typically the better player is not that number one pick. Now, you may say, well, of course, right, because the chances are when there's 60 players in the case of the NBA, 60 players drafted, the chances that you get the best one at the number one pick, maybe there's some math to it that would tell you it makes no difference if you're picking first or at least in the top 10. If you're picking 30th, your chances go down. But maybe, you know, the arithmetic tell you that everyone's on a level playing field and so it really doesn't make much of a difference. Who you take, it's still a 50-50 proposition if they work out or not. So you could still get the best player of the draft later in the first round. I don't know. I don't know what the analytics would say, where the chances are to find the best player. Because, of course, if you pick number one, you have the whole pool to choose from. So you have everybody available on your board where if you're picking fifth, you can't choose from it. You just have to choose from who's available. So I don't really know if it's a type of deal where it's just a product of the system or if these are just teams screwing it up. Should the best player be taken number one every year? Theoretically, yes, but it is such a crapshoot that maybe it's hard to try to expect any team to just nail the best player in that draft each and every year. But of course, when you're picking one, the benefit why you want to be number one is because you could choose from everybody. So you can make your choice. You look at the entire field. You say, okay, yep, this is the best guy. Whereas, like I said, if you're picking fifth, well, now you have to take away the four top players. Now here's who you're picking from. Hopefully one of these guys will be the best. But I say all that, and I don't know if I even made that clear enough as I try to run it through my head and wonder how we've gotten to this point. But I say all that because when I look back at the NBA and we try to compare Ja Morant to Zion, and you know, we give Zion a hard time because Ja's been better, and he has. It's not that Zion is some sort of outlier. It's actually more that this has been the case in the NBA. The last two drafts, it's too soon to determine. Cade Cunningham this year for the Pistons? Maybe. Anthony Edwards last year for the Timberwolves went first overall? Yeah, he may be the best player from the draft class. He's looked pretty good. Him and Cade Cunningham have both played well so far, better than even I was anticipating. But starting in 2019 with Zion Williamson, at least to this point, it's been clear he was not the best player, or has not been, I'll say. He has not been the best player in that draft class. It has certainly been Ja Morant to this point. Then you go back to 2018. That was when DeAndre Ayton went first overall. I would take Luka Doncic. 2017, Markelle Fultz went first overall. I would take Jason Tatum. And I'm just giving you one name. There's other names, too. I would take over some of these guys. In 2016, Ben Simmons went first overall. Now, we could debate it, but in terms of what you've gotten more out of, I don't know, maybe you'd rather have Jamal Murray. Simmons may be more talented, but between the inability to shoot or the unwillingness, and now this year missing the whole season, now he's going to have back surgery, and it's been a little bit of a head case for some of these teams. I think if I could redraft who I would rather have on my team, right, I think you're going Jamal Murray right now as opposed to Ben Simmons. Some of these may be a little more debatable, such as the previous year, 2015. Karl Anthony Towns went first overall. He's had a good career. But I think I'd go with Devin Booker as just one name from this draft over Cat. And Devin Booker was drafted in the teens. 2014, Andrew Wiggins went first overall. Joel Embiid was drafted in that draft class. I think you're taking Embiid. In 2013, pick whoever you want because Anthony Bennett went first overall. He played 151 games in his NBA career. So, I mean, take your choice. You can find anybody in that draft class that you would rather have. Rudy Gobert was in that draft class. C.J. McCollum. Victor Oladipo was in that draft class, just to name a few. Anybody. Anthony Bennett was out of the league in 3 years. 2012 is probably the outlier. You have Anthony Davis. Although, as good as Anthony Davis is, he just hasn't been healthy. In fact, Jay Crowder just passed Anthony Davis for most career points in the playoff. I mean, that's kind of embarrassing to Anthony Davis. Just the fact that he hasn't been there enough and he hasn't been healthy enough. So while Anthony Davis would be the most talented player, Damian Lillard went in that draft class. Would it sound ridiculous to say you'd rather have Damian Lillard than Anthony Davis? I don't know. If both are healthy, maybe Anthony Davis is the bigger star, but that's a big question. If you had to pick a player right now to come be on your team, are you taking Anthony Davis or Damian Lillard? I think it'd be a pretty good debate. 2011, Kyrie Irving went first overall. And this may be the one that, for me, isn't all that debatable. Now, again, we could talk about Kyrie's never been dependable. He's not available. I think Kyrie is the most talented player in that draft class. But you did have Klay Thompson in that draft class. You did have Jimmy Butler in that draft class. And at least when healthy, you had somebody like Kemba Walker in that draft class. I think I'm still sticking with Kyrie, but you could make a pretty good case, I'm sure, for Jimmy Butler over Kyrie Irving right now. Jimmy at least is going to be out there and give you his best effort. I don't want to keep going too long on this, but going back to 2010, John Wall, first overall. You know, he's been beat up, has not been great these last couple of years, hasn't won a playoff series in 6 years. Maybe you'd rather have a Paul George. Maybe you'd rather have, he's been injured lately, but a Gordon Hayward. So on and so forth. We could go on and through all the years of the number one picks. More often than not, they have not worked out. Prior to John Wall, you have Blake Griffin, you have Derrick Rose, then you get to your Greg Oden in 2007, Andrea Bargnani in 2006, even Andrew Bogut was the first overall pick 2005. We had a pretty good stretch where you went from Dwight Howard to LeBron James to Yao Ming. That's a pretty good stretch of number one picks. But the point being, more often than not, the majority of the time, in fact, almost all the time, the number one pick actually is not the best player in their draft class, not only for the NBA, but the NFL as well. So when we're hard on Zion or the Pelicans, we have to be fair in that, well, they're not alone. Most teams seem to botch that number one pick. And so I go back to my original points to start this segment, and I don't have the answer. I don't know if it's just not that much of an advantage as we believe it is to be picking first overall. I don't know if it's just that it's an inexact science, that no matter who's picking first overall, it's still going to be a crapshoot. None of these teams have the answers, and you can't predict how a 20-year-old is going to do in the NBA or in the NFL. I don't know if some sort of math teacher could show me the analytics that show you that there actually isn't an advantage to picking first overall. I don't know. But if you go back and you look, the history shows us that picking first in the NBA, the NFL, hasn't really been that great advantage that we think it is. Either teams are doing a bad job, we're hyping up the wrong players, or no matter where you're picking in the draft, it's always going to be a flip of the coin. But number one picks in the NBA, just like the NFL, have not been the best players in their draft class. They have not, in a lot of cases, been all that successful. You would think if you're picking first overall, you got the pick of the litter. You could pick anybody you want. Just pick out the best player in the draft class. You'd have a much higher hit rate than a normal draft pick. That has not been the case. In fact, they've had probably a lower hit rate than some other number picks in the draft. So I was thinking about it while watching John Morant in this postseason and thinking back to the NFL draft. And, you know, I'm guilty of it as well, being hard on Zion. And it's not to defend Zion Williamson because he's been a huge disappointment, but let's just make sure we don't look at it as some sort of outlier. Like, can you believe how bad Zion's been as a number one? Well, yeah, I can believe it because it seems year in and year out, the best player doesn't go number one in these drafts. And I don't know why that is. But that's just the latest example where the best player went later on in the draft than the first overall pick. And it usually happens that way. So keep that in mind as we get closer to the NBA draft. And we talk about, really, it's going to be the three names you hear probably most often at the top of the draft board. But consider that most years, the last 15 years in the NBA, the best player actually doesn't go first overall. They're still available later on. We just don't know it at the time. When we come back, I've been talking about it throughout the afternoon, so we will pay off the tease next. We had quite the upset in the Kentucky Derby on Saturday. So, since we do a top 10 list every Tuesday, the obvious connection would be the 10 biggest upsets in sports. And I think what we saw Saturday, I think does fit into the top 10. I'll give you my top 10 list when we come back. It's the Moore Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Attention campers, lunch has been canceled today due to lack of hustle. Deal with it.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
Coming up, the biggest upsets in sports history. We'll get to that as part of our Tuesday Top 10. If you ever miss anything from the show, you can always catch it on demand. Just search ESPN Radio Charleston, however you listen to your podcast. And the podcasts are always available online at charlestonsportsradio.com as well. Earlier this afternoon, we were talking about the Kentucky Derby from Saturday, and what a surprise it was to see Rich Strike win as an 80-1 underdog, second largest underdog to win the Kentucky Derby, and you know how long that they've been running this race. So it's pretty remarkable what was accomplished. If you missed our conversation from the first hour, find it on demand, but Trent and I then ran through some things that have similar odds, 80-1 in other sports, to see what else could be as likely to occur like what we saw Saturday. But it also got me thinking because every Tuesday we do a top 10 list. So the easy top 10 list idea this week is to do the 10 biggest upsets in sports history. Does Saturday's Kentucky Derby fit into the top 10? We'll find out because it's time now for our Tuesday Top 10.
Time for the Tuesday Top 10, where we rank anything from quarterbacks to cheeseburgers right here on the Morrow Midday Show. Interested?
Ten biggest upsets
in sports history. Let's start with number 10. I'm going to go with the Miracle Mets. 1969, the New York Mets win their first ever World Series. Now, they started as a franchise in 1962 and never had a winning season leading into the 69 season. The year prior, they lost 89 games. They lost over 100 games most times. In fact, of course, they set the record for most losses for a baseball team when they first started early on. And they went up against the Orioles, who were going through a stretch in which they at least reached 4 World Series in 7 years. And the Miracle Mets of 1969, Cleon Jones with the shoe polish mark on the hit-by-pitch, they find a way to win that World Series. They won 100 games that year after never winning more than 73 in their existence. And in 1969, also, by the way, the Mets lost the first game of the World Series and then won the next 4. Led by Gil Hodges, Tom Seaver on the mound, they win a World Series just 7 years into existence, beating a powerhouse in Baltimore. So I put the Miracle Mets of 1969 at number 10. Number 9 on the biggest upsets in sports history, I'm going to go Patriots-Rams, the first Tom Brady Super Bowl. The Patriots were 14-point underdogs against the greatest show on turf. Now, it was more about what Belichick did to slow down that defense than what Tom Brady did on offense. He only had 145 yards, and Vinatieri hit the game-winning kick. But the Patriots, at the time, if you're of a certain age, you may only remember the Patriots as you know them today. Back then, the Patriots were not a great franchise. They were starting Tom Brady, who nobody knew. He replaced Drew Bledsoe. Somehow they got to the Super Bowl. Bill Belichick was just a failure in Cleveland at that point. He was not some sort of greatest coach of all time. And he had, on the other side, the Rams, who had a great year. They were 2 touchdown favorites. They had Hall of Famers Kurt Warner, Orlando Pace. You had Marshall Faulk, Isaac Bruce, Torrey Holt, and the Patriots shut them down and won. And I remember where I was watching that Super Bowl. Nobody saw it coming. And the Patriots, as 14-point dogs, won the first of many Super Bowls in Tom Brady's tenure. I put that at number 9. In fact, I have a run of Super Bowls here because number 8, I go back to the well of the Patriots, but on the losing side. The Patriots 2008, when they lost to the Giants for the first time in the Super Bowl, that's the 8th biggest upset for me. The Giants were 12.5-point underdogs. You had Eli, still pretty early on in his career, against Tom Brady. That was a mismatch. And you had, of course, most notably the fact that the Patriots were 18-0. Now, the Giants did hang in there, tough with them, final game of the regular season. I remember listening to that game on the way back from the airport and then watching the end at home. But that was a big, like, you know, the Giants believing, hey, we could beat these guys. And the Giants got red hot that time of the year, going into the playoffs, made that run to the Super Bowl, played great, beat the Patriots. I put it at number 8 of the biggest upsets, the Giants in 2008 knocking off the undefeated Patriots in that Super Bowl. Number 7 is another Super Bowl. Jets-Colts Super Bowl III, when Joe Namath guaranteed the victory. The Colts were 18-point favorites. It's the largest upset in NFL Super Bowl history. The Jets were 18-point dogs. Remember, this was still before the merger, so they're in the AFL. You had Namath against Unitas, and the Colts were of the NFL, which was always seen as the powerhouse. The Jets were 18-point dogs, and they held the Colts to 7 points and won that Super Bowl. I probably should have put this higher on the list, being that they were 18-point underdogs and won a Super Bowl, but I put it at number 7. Number 6 of the largest upsets in sports history. I go at 1985 Villanova for the entirety of the tournament, not just the national championship. Villanova won the championship that year as an 8 seed, and they beat Georgetown in the championship. Now, Georgetown had beaten them in the regular season. They're both out of the Big East. Georgetown won the regular season matchups. You had Patrick Ewing on the other side off to the NBA, had never won a championship. This was his last chance, and you had Villanova as an 8 seed get it done. There's a reason why we haven't seen this be duplicated in college basketball. Even with as many upsets as we get now and Cinderella stories, we haven't had a story like Villanova from 35 years ago winning it all as an 8 seed. And on top of it all, maybe it means that it was more of a fluke. I don't know. But remember, in that national title game, they shot 79% from the floor, which is absurd. And they still only won by 2 against Georgetown. So it just shows how big of a gap that there was, that they made almost 80% of their shots and still almost lost. That's how much better Georgetown seemed to be than Villanova. But Villanova getting it done and Rolly Massimino running around on the court afterwards, 6 biggest upset. Number 5, this is where I put Saturday's Kentucky Derby with Rich Strike. I think that's the 5th biggest upset in sports history, and I don't think I'm being a prisoner of the moment. 80-1 odds, second longest long shot to ever win the Kentucky Derby, which has been going on for over 100 years. And the extra wrinkle is that he was added to the race the day before.
and nobody knew who this horse was or their trainer or anything. Bought for $30,000. That would be like, to try to compare this to another sport, maybe this is too extreme, but it'd almost be like if Trent was at a sitting courtside at a game, they bring him into the game in the fourth quarter, and he's the leading, he takes over. He's the star of the fourth quarter.
I'm good for an easy 15, no doubt about it. Come on now, Luke, just sit me on the three. Get me in the corner.
All right, so maybe it's not as far-fetched. But you get the idea, right? Rich Strike was not even in the field the day before. He's added in. Nobody knows who he is. He's an 80-1 long shot, and he wins the race. It's crazy. It'd be like, someone coming off the street and dominating a fourth quarter of a playoff game in the NBA or Major League Baseball. They get a save in the ninth inning of a playoff game. Some guy off the street, right? They catch the touchdown pass. They have 10 catches in the fourth quarter of a Super Bowl. You had no idea who they were. It's wild. 80-1. Number four, the biggest upsets, I go Buster Douglas, who was a nobody and knocked out Mike Tyson. 50-1 underdog, and he beat Tyson. And it was the way he beat him. You may remember Tyson putting his mouthpiece in backwards, right? He was so shaken up afterwards. And the difference why I put this number four, right, because the odds are not as good as Rich Strike from Saturday. He was a bigger long shot than Buster Douglas. Probably same with the Jets against the Colts. The difference, though, for me when it comes to boxing is just the physicality. I mean, you're fighting. So there's a difference there than, I don't know, a basketball game. It just feels different when you impose, like, your will on somebody. And you knock him out, and you knock him down, and nobody saw it coming, and you're 50-1 underdog. Yeah, you ever get into a fight with somebody back in the day? Every school had that. We'll meet you at 3 o'clock in the woods in the back. Right? You all had that area where fights would go on. And it's just a little bit different when there's an upset in a fight because it's such a grueling, physical thing. You're throwing punches at one another. You're trying to knock the other person out. And so when you get knocked out, and it's a big surprise, I think that rings even larger than, you know, like a baseball team winning a surprise game. Or even a football game as physical as that is. It's a little bit different when you knock somebody out in the process of the upset. Number three of the largest upsets in sports history. Maybe this is getting a little too much in the weeds, but I actually go with the horse called Upset. Now, I don't know when the term upset originated. I imagine it was already part of the language when the horse Upset won about 120 years ago. Maybe that's where we get the term from. I don't know, but he was a 100-1 long shot. And he beat Man O' War, who had never lost a race before. Now, this is going way back over 100 years. It was the early 1900s. But Rich Strike, as I mentioned, second longest long shot to win the Kentucky Derby at 80-1. A horse named Upset won. It wasn't the Kentucky Derby, but it was the Sanford Memorial Stakes as a 100-1 underdog. Even greater than what we saw from Rich Strike. Plus, you had Man O' War in that race as well. And the horse called Upset won. And with a name like that, come on, it was fitting. That's number three. Top two. Number two is the U.S. beating the Soviet Union in 1980. The remarkable thing about this is that they were using professionals and Team USA was not. They were using amateurs, and they still won in the semifinals to beat a powerhouse. And we all, you know about it. You hear the Michaels call all the time. They made a movie about it. Everybody thinks back to it, especially around Olympic time. It's number two of the greatest upsets. I can't put it at number one as much as I would love to because number one, and we've talked about this before, and I know they pronounce the name different than how it looks. I think is it Leicester City? I'm not into soccer.
Leicester City.
Yeah, it is Leicester City. I think this is the greatest upset in sports history. They had 5,000-1 odds, right? So to put that in perspective, Saturday, Rich Strike, second biggest upset in Kentucky Derby history, that was 80-1. Leicester City was 5,000-1 to win the Premier League, and they did. They had just been relegated, which, you know, you're not good enough, you get bumped down. 5,000-1 odds. Nobody saw it coming. They were supposed to be the bottom of the barrel. They go on to win. I'd have to look up who has 5,000-1 odds right now, let's say in college football, right, for comparison's sake. But that is crazy. I think from an odds perspective, that also has to be the largest upset. Have we ever seen another victory in sports where the winner was 5,000-1 or greater? I don't think you can top that. I'm not a big soccer guy. I can't put it into necessarily perspective otherwise, you know, other than saying 5,000-1 odds, that's all I need to hear. They've been relegated. They were supposed to be the worst team in the league. 5,000-1 odds, and they win the whole thing. Crazy. I think that's the greatest sports upset that we've had. So those are the top 10. And I do think what we saw Saturday, not to be a prisoner of the moment, something I always warn against, but I think that Kentucky Derby surprise, that is already in the top 10.
second largest upset we've ever had in a Kentucky Derby. And again, you know how long they've been running that race for. So to be number two, that's pretty remarkable. Our Tuesday top 10 for this week, looking at the 10 biggest upsets. Let me try to find let's make for great radio. Let me try to find a college football team here to try to put this into perspective of 5,000 to 1 odds.
The Houston Texans are 225 to 1 to win the Super Bowl this year.
225.
Yeah, put that in perspective.
Jeez.
But think about that. When you talk about Leicester City with the 5,000, like they were not even supposed to get off the bus, Luke. It's unbelievable.
No. Okay, so I think – let me see here. No, that's not even enough. Like Louisiana Lafayette is 500 to 1 to win the NCAA – to win the national championship in college football.
Look out. Put your tickets in now,
yeah.
Folks.
1,000. The book I'm looking at, the largest odds they have are 1,000 to 1. Leicester City was 5,000 to 1. 1,000 to 1 in college football would be South Florida, Georgia Southern, Toledo, Texas State, Vanderbilt, Northern Illinois, North Texas, Florida Atlantic, Nevada, Western Kentucky, New Mexico State, UAB, Central Michigan, Charlotte, Bowling Green, Ball State, Colorado State. Wow, there's a lot here. UConn, let's go. Eastern Michigan, so on and so forth. There are a lot of teams that have, but that's the highest they go. So to try to put it in perspective, it would be five times less likely than UConn winning the national championship this year in college football. Leicester City winning it all about, what, 6 years ago in the Premier League? Greatest sports upset or surprise, however you want to phrase it, that we've ever seen, and I don't know if it will be topped anytime soon. That is remarkable because the odds don't even go that high for most of these sports. We'll wrap up your Tuesday when we come back. It's more Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Yo, what up?
What's the word, big fella? Everything's good on this end.
Hey, Luke, how's it going? Thanks for having me on the show.
Hey, Luke. Hey, man. Pleasure to be on your show.
I'm doing great, but I'm hoping you could call me Boca Baby.
Great show. You're doing a good job.
You're turning into rapidly my favorite person I've interviewed with, and I've done like 50 of these in the last week.
You've done your homework. I like it. I absolutely like it. I love that.
Another great thought.
You've done your homework, haven't you? Good job.
You've always get these big stars and important people on. That's great to hear. We'd like to hear the interviews.
You know, it's uncanny how you do this, Luke. And I don't know how you do, because I do this gauntlet of radio on Thursdays, where I do all these different cities. Many of them need their hosts to have me give them some talking points. You hit all my talking points every week. It's uncanny how good you are.
Always great talking football with you, Luke. Appreciate you guys being right.
Very impressive.
Just want to say, I find you the Low Country Colin Coward. You use common sense with statistics, and you combine them, and you think outside the box.
Shout out to all the people in Charleston that support the show.
Tell your friends. Tell your friends.
Da-da-da-da-da. Da-da-da-da. Go ahead, boy. That's how you bring it on.
Is this a sports show or a dancing show?
I don't know. Sometimes I don't know what we're doing around here.
Well, it's with Luke for 3 hours. Anything goes.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
Wrapping up your Tuesday on the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow on ESPN Radio. It's been good to get back. If you ever miss anything from the show, you can always catch it on demand. Just search ESPN Radio Charleston however you listen to your podcast. And don't forget, you can take the Morrow Midday Show with you wherever you go. Just stream us online at charlestonsportsradio.com or through TuneIn Radio, your smart speaker, or our free app. Search ESPN Charleston in the App Store. And through the app, can listen to the show live or on demand from anywhere in the world. Appreciate listeners checking in from at least 10 different states and multiple countries on this Tuesday afternoon. We were talking earlier about the draft picks and how the number one draft pick very infrequently is actually the best player in that draft class for any sport. On Twitter, Chip said he brought up a good point about the greatest player in NFL history, arguably. Tom Brady went 199th overall. So it speaks to the inexact science that is the draft for any of these sports. I think if you're the number one team, you certainly, I guess, have the higher chances of things going your way in trying to get the best player. But
But it is such an inexact science, and it is so hard to predict these players at the age of 21, how they're going to be for the next 10, 15, 20 years, that I don't think it's as big of an advantage as we actually believe to have that number one pick. It helps because you have a larger pool to choose from, so the odds are probably greater than if you were picking, just say, in the third round. But I don't know if it's as big of an advantage as some may believe, thinking that always, every year, that number one pick should be the best player. Yeah, maybe theoretically, but it usually doesn't work that way. Also on Twitter, Brad asked, he said, Braves, Red Sox, two-game series starts tonight. Place a wager on it, loser buys lunch. Well, I hope it's a split with a two-game series. That's the best I can hope for. The Red Sox right now have the third worst record in baseball, or at least in the AL, and they're on the road in Atlanta. I don't know if I could bet on my team right now. I'm just hoping for a split. If you ever miss anything from the show, catch it on demand. Don't forget Citadel Baseball tonight at 6. Life is a series of hellos and goodbyes. For now, we say goodbye. We'll say hello again tomorrow at noon. It's the Mora Midday Show on ESPN Radio.